yeah, so I am hungover.
That party was crazy.
Fun times, but bad planning in the Fuller household.
And you need one of those. You need one of those planning assistants.
Man, y'all need Jesus. But yeah, let's go for it. I am
all right.
Medicated. I'm partially caffeinated. Let's do this.
Medicated, caffeinated,
indoctrinated.
Indoctrinated. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Indeed.
Exactly.
these are the ways.
These are the ways. Absolutely. Okay. So what do we got? What do we got on our plate today?
One of my personal favorites of recent history in horror. This is
okay.
A lot of people, like in the Wandverse of horror, a lot of people would probably go Conjuring. This one has a bit of a more special place in my heart. It's I don't want to get ahead of ourselves because there's things and reasons why in later chapters. I want to strictly focus on this first installment, this initiation into the Further.
Okay.
So we're talking the 2010, it was finished in 2010, released in 2011, horror class, now I will call classic, Insidious.
Excuse me. You kind of like stopped yourself there for a second.
You're I
like,
realized I how ridiculous what I realized what I was saying was absurd. So checked myself before I wrecked
myself. What is the, how long do you have to go before you can consider something a classic? What is the time frame?
I personally don't consider it a time constraint. I consider it a quality restraint.
Okay.
That's one man's opinion. I know there's different.
So like, if you saw something for the very first time, would you, are you willing to give something like an instant classic? Do you believe in that? Like immediately classic?
I think some things, yeah, but I do think that that has a knee-jerk quality to it where it's like, you can be very starstruck and be very wrong. That's why I think that there just needs to at least be some kind of a breathing period, you know, give it some time to, you know, cross-reference your old favorites and like see how it compares. I think that there's just an inherent, you know, you gotta let it breathe a little bit.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But I really do love Insidious. It's a very interesting, like, just like the core concepts of like what makes this world work and like how this machine turns. It's I think it's one of the most interesting takes on the afterlife in a horror movie, personally.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I haven't seen all of the Insidious films to date, but
yes, and there's a number of them.
Yeah, I do like, you know, like I've always said, I'm a sucker for lore. I do like the rules that this kind of sets forth, which is interesting.
What
for
are the
movie.
Rules? But yes, I strongly agree. And we were talking a little bit last week with Outlast how, you know, expansive lore and horror is something of a rarity that is only just within recent history, given and kind of really being explored.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it all depends, too, on like what you're referring to or what you're talking about. But I think there's always lore there from my perspective, like the history of like how the place is haunted or the monster or like, oh, this person, you know, did it. Or you know, you look at Sleepy Hollow, the original.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
You got it.
No.
I know it's in there.
No, it's not. I'm blanking. Who? Hang on. I got to look. We cannot continue until I get the information I need at the moment.
Washington Irving?
Thank you.
Yeah. I didn't. I was like not jumping to like crush your research there. But like.
No, I just like, you just get those things where you're like, who the frick is the author? I know the name.
I know it's in there, but I can't. I know the file is in the cabinet, but I can't seem to find it.
Yeah. I put it right here. I'm telling you, I took a right here. It happened.
It's like the dad thing. It's like, who moved my file?
But yes, I'm thinking of like that where you get like a little bit of backstory on the Headless Horseman and who he was. Not too much. But one thing I like about Insidious, or I think that's different, is it tries to, like I said, the rules, it really starts to kind of like almost apply like a scientific aspect to
it's like that practical reasoning to like why are these strange things happening throughout like mankind, like what are like ghost stories, what are like, what is the afterlife, these inexplainable things. It tries to put like a rational explanation on them,
which is very different for a horror story, because usually horror story, that's where the concept of a lot of the horror comes from, is just
the
fact
knowing.
That you, the unknowing, and you have no idea how to fight this thing, where it comes from. It's just you're at its mercy. And this, it gives the characters a little bit more, not off the bat they have to discover it, but it tries to set some goalposts or define a perimeter of like, okay, here's in, what's in bounds, what's out of bounds.
It gives the characters some tools to actually potentially win.
Yeah.
Which is rare for a horror movie. Usually, a goal in writing a horror movie is to strip your characters of weapons and tools against the antagonist. So it's an interestingly different take in a lot of ways.
Yes.
So let's dig in. Let's dive into it. Yeah. So one of the biggest concepts of the entire Insidious franchise, but is introduced in this first installment, is the concept of the Further. And what the Further is basically like a mediation. They describe it a couple of different ways in different installments, but basically it's like in the way it's described in this first installment, it's kind of like a halfway point between the reality we know and understand and whatever the afterlife is. So it's kind of like a ferrying of souls kind of arena.
Yeah, like a limbo type aspect. At least that's how I took it.
It's described as being like outside of the realm of what we understand time to be. So there's a lot of strange aspects to it. Like you can travel from one place to another within the Further and affect the real world. And there's all kinds of chaotic rules that evolve and change throughout the installments to some degree. But
it has a lot of like quantum physics stuff going on.
Yeah, which is partly what my kind of draw, like, you know.
Yeah, or it feels like it was at least inspired by, you know, principles of quantum physics. Not that I'm a quantum physicist.
Well, no, but I mean, you know, we're both studied gentlemen of the arena through various storytelling installments. So.
Yeah.
We know a thing or two, maybe not, you know, astrophysicist level, but.
But yes, I'm going to start firing that up on my resume.
I've seen all episodes of Stargate, so I think I'm qualified.
You see that sitting in an interview, you're like at CERN or NASA, like I'm just like picturing you like, so what are your qualifications? I've seen
all 500 episodes of Stargate, so I think I got this.
Oh, goddamn. Okay, continue.
So, yeah, the Further is a fascinating arena, a fascinating concept. Elise, the character of Elise that comes in at kind of the midpoint, I would say, of the film, is the certified expert. There's a lot of cool things with this. It was you get the sense, it's never been explicitly stated, but you get the sense that this was kind of written as something, or at least drew inspiration from the original Poltergeist movie as like a baseboard, because like there's some heavy nods to it, and there's a lot of like plot structure things that fall in parallel to the Poltergeist. So it's definitely inspired by it, I would say. So like that whole other world kind of situation in Poltergeist, you don't see the other world ever.
Yeah, you never really see it. No,
implied, but there's a lot of cool parallels and there's a lot of cool nods, like the specs after he's laying in the kitchen with the stakes on his eyes. There's like the way they position that and stuff. It's kind of a nod to it, to the scene Poltergeist with the stakes and
and the stake like decaying. Yeah,
the kitchen itself is kind of visually similar, so it's like there's that as well. But
the setting of just being in like a normal suburban area.
Yeah,
that was a big thing that we talked about last year with Poltergeist, that Poltergeist did.
Yeah.
You know, instead of, it took it out of the, you know, the creepy old Victorian type house, you know, something that like, you know, becomes cliche or you just automatically think of when you think of like a haunted house.
Yeah.
And plucked it out of that.
And speaking of haunted houses, this is actually featured this year at Halloween Horror Nights. And it is.
Oh, my God.
I also haven't mentioned on the air that I actually have already been, and it was fantastic.
Yes.
I was a little wary if I was going to get to go this year, but it was great.
But you did.
I did. Well, quick hop in, hop out. We did all the houses and got back, but it was fantastic. I would say within one man's opinion again that it's the best house that they've ever done.
Insidious.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And I was shocked by that. That's, was not going in expecting that.
That's interesting. All right. That's high praise.
Yeah, it was just like a lot of new experimental techniques that fit directly with the story. They nailed each of the locations. It was just top tier. Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
But okay. I'm currently wearing my merch, my Insidious merch.
You always get merch.
Dude, I have a problem. You don't know that by now? But yeah, it's a little sidetrack. I felt that I needed to acknowledge HHN is a core theme through our horror episodes. I thought it was worth mentioning.
Yes.
But yeah, the Further is a fascinating concept. It is like the core influx of how a lot of the plot is allowed to happen throughout the Insidious franchise, but especially in this first installment.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the story of this initial movie goes, it's that Dalton, their eldest son, the Lambert family, who is the core unit of the character structure in Insidious, their oldest child, Dalton, who's about 10, I believe, whenever this occurs,
yeah,
he just falls asleep one night and just doesn't wake up the following morning. Yeah. It's inexplicable. The best explanation that the doctors can come up with is that he's in a coma, but they're not even 100% sure about that.
Mm-hmm.
They can't really explain it because none of his symptoms, quote unquote, or like the way he's reacting line up with their diagnosis. So they kind of just send him home with, sorry, we can't help you. Mm-hmm. And they set him up with a feeding tube and a hospital bed. And then all these weird things start happening around the house, blood red handprints and things, all kinds of chaos, all kind of like seemingly multiple spirits entering the household. And
oh, I can remember too, when this was like first, you know, advertised, like the trailers and stuff or like the posters, I can always remember it being, it's one of the taglines was like, it's not the house that's haunted.
Yeah. Which is the scariest part of it is because you can't even just get up and leave. It's,
yeah,
you know, it's kind of like Poltergeist, but it's going to follow you.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, it starts to unfold. We learn through the course of the story unfolding. Obviously, this is getting into heavy spoilers. I don't want to ruin this for anybody, so this is everyone's chance to walk out the door, go check out the movie, and come back once you've had the opportunity to check it out for yourself. So you've been warned. Spoilers in play. We find out that Dalton is actually a gifted astral projector. So mm-hmm. I'm sure everybody's heard the term astral projection before, you know, where your soul or your spirit leaves.
Yeah, I mean, if you've watched Marvel, they do it in Doctor Strange a lot.
They dabble in it quite a bit, yeah. And so Dalton has been feeling like he's been experiencing dreams when in reality, he's been leaving his physical body and just drifting off in his waking, his sleep-wake cycle.
Yeah.
And during one of these astral projection sessions of his, he just gets lost and can't find his way back to his body. And this goes on for about 3 whole months that before we see any kind of significant happenstance with the spirits entering the home.
Mm-hmm.
The Lambert family decides to move. Then after a short period, the occurrences start up just as quickly again. They are seeing all kinds of spirits, all kinds of strange happenstance. So it's clearly something else is going on. They're trying to dig further and find out what is happening.
What a not that it invented the concept of like the astral projection, but what a concept to use.
Yeah, they definitely utilize it better than anything else I've ever seen. Like, obviously, it's a concept that's not new, but
no, and that's one thing too when you're writing stories. We've talked about it many times. It's hard to create something absolutely new, but how do you take something that is familiar but fresh? How do you give it your spin?
Yeah, and it's a tricky balance, but you know, the Wan crew, obviously they were very new to the scene at this time.
Mm-hmm.
Lee Wan-El is kind of his direct collaborator, who he tends to take a lot of roles in Wan's movies, but he's his co-writer with a lot of the stuff that he does. So they're kind of a traveling unit. They do a lot together, but they're a lot of people would remember him as in Saw, he's Cary Elwes. In the room and Saw, yeah. So that was the one, the first big Wanverse note on the radar was Saw. Mm-hmm. There were movies, it's horror movies they had done prior to that, but that was the first big success of theirs.
I can remember trying to get into Saw 3 back in high school. I was the only one that was 17 at the time in my group.
Yeah.
It was just like, you know, it was like, no, give me your ID. I got to see your ID.
that gentleman sounds pleasant. Yeah, so the Further is, like we said, is a very fascinating concept. It delves deeper in the other installments, but it's very much a plot vehicle in this first installment, just to kind of get from point A to point B and explain, you know, some very complex concepts quickly, and it achieves that goal in spades. It allows the plot to just accelerate at a perfectly paced breakneck pace.
Yeah.
Like, things just get faster and faster and faster, and the amount of information that it conveys so quickly is kind of bewildering. I just watched it a couple of nights ago, and I was like, this really is, like, if this has one superpower, it's pacing and it's edit.
Yeah, no, I mean, yes, that is, especially the one, like, anything he does, I will say his pacing seems to be a better aspect than most.
Yeah, and it's the visual side. We mentioned the parallels with Poltergeist. I thought it was interesting when I found out that the DP of Insidious was actually an operator on the original Poltergeist.
Oh, okay.
So I'm like, there's some cool tie-ins, but like there's clearly intent of drawing from that as like a playbook, which I thought was just really cool, because it's like, it's not at face value something you would think of, but it's very much there.
Yeah.
But yeah, as to get more into the plot, as things progress, we find out that Dalton's father, Josh Lambert, dealt with very similar issues when he was a child, and to cover it up, they ended up performing hypnosis on him to cause him to forget, and that's how they were able to suppress his ability. And he goes into the further to save Dalton. That's the course of the plot. One of the things that I think the Wanverse of horror is very good at, obviously in The Conjuring especially, is crafting really interesting spirits for like the their versions of the afterlife.
Well, they do a lot. They do a good job with the production design and like create there is like a fantasy element to his horror movies, if I can say that,
to a point where it's like it is extreme world building.
Yeah,
so much so that you look at how The Conjuring has evolved. They've spawned how many different spinoffs, The Nun, you know, Annabelle, all these, like it's they're literally franchising out that whole thing. So
no, it definitely goes, what's the word I'm looking for, this one definitely, or the Insidious, The Conjuring movies, The Nun, those definitely do not have that sort of, like, if you compare it to something like The Witch, you know, you can see, I would say that's like, you can definitely see the difference in the two. Like, this one, Insidious and Conjuring are more kind of in your face scares.
Jump scares.
Yeah,
like, for sure.
A lot of over the top scenes. But that's the style. That's what they're going for.
Many would argue it as popcorn horror, which is like,
you could say,
like, you could say that, but I do believe there's some solid artistic elements to this. So like, it's not quite so definable as that, but it definitely, you can definitely fit it into that category.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting, because it's, you know, for something as profitable as this to also have an artistic edge, like that's the superpower, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It's like, if you can have something that's like creatively engaging and also a huge financial success, like this made like, I think, $110 million, and it was very low. Like, it was a very nominal budget. Like, it was not
not
huge.
A very bad. Well, you see that a lot with horror movies, no? Like, because they tend to be a little bit cheaper to produce.
That's why they still have life, is because producers are looking at the numbers and they're like, whoa, this thing was made for like next to nothing and it made this much, so the ratio there is crazy.
Yeah, like I can remember when we were in school, like Paranormal Activity, I think, was just coming out or had just come out, and
they made those things for like pennies. That I think it was like the third or fourth one they shot entirely on GoPros.
Yeah, and then they laughed their way all to the bank.
Absolutely. Yeah, like the people who criticize those, like, go ahead, like they're making bank.
So. I know. Yeah, it's like, well, look at, and things like Blair Witch too, like the original found footage.
Yeah, you can do that same style and like have something that's extremely artistic too.
Yeah.
So it's like it's all in how you use it and how you play with things. I mean, there's always a way to do anything you want to do.
Yeah, but it is amazing how horror gets that, you know, gets that rap in terms of not being as artistically savvy or as critically acclaimed. We know we talked about this last year with The Exorcist. That's one of the few horror movies ever to sort of break that wall. But
and did so, like, it shocked, that one shocked the industry, like they weren't ready for it, especially at the Oscars. I think it was one of the times like a horror movie like stormed the Oscars. So interesting, very, very interesting. But the Lambert family, I think, are a very interestingly balanced set of characters. Obviously secrets being in play with keeping things from Josh, his mother being the gatekeeper for a lot of those secrets.
You know, I like the acting in this too. Like,
oh my god, it, yeah, like it has
like Rose Byrne, Patrick Wilson
performances.
Yeah, I don't know. I know it gets hard. It's one of those things where like I've noticed this. I'm gonna go a little bit off on a tangent here, but you don't quite kind of really appreciate or see good acting until you see like bad acting or something, or yes, you work with bad acting, or just how tough it is to make a film in any way, any aspect, you know. And like, you know, yes, you could argue maybe you don't like the Insidious movies, maybe they're not the greatest, whatever. It's still hard to not, when I see like, you know, movies like this, it's still hard for me not to be like tip a hat a little bit, because you and I have been on the behind the lens and we know, yes, how difficult it can be to just make it seem normal, to have it that normal, like, you know, look.
Well, especially when you're working with kids, you know, it's extremely tough, yeah, to cast young children and then have them prove themselves. You know, it's not always an easy, especially for a film like this that features them so heavily.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's tricky.
And I feel like that would always be rough too, shooting like a horror film with,
yeah, and
with
trying
children
to keep it a safe environment for them. You know, that's not easy.
Mm-hmm.
Especially like, oh, I know I've talked to you about this before. Dalton Lambert, who is played by Ty Simpkins.
Yeah.
I actually do want to do this in a dedicated episode at some point, because I do think it's okay, both hilarious and fascinating at the same time. But have you,
yes,
have I discussed with you the Ty Simpkins paradox?
I don't think so.
So we are doing this in a dedicated episode, but there's
all right.
just to give like a glassed over kind of view, like this has driven some people I know very, very well quite crazy and quite maddened, because
what is this now? What are you bringing to the table here?
So Jurassic World, which Ty Simpkins starred in,
uh-huh,
as one of the children,
yes,
had a very delayed start. I think it was like a few years before, like because of post-production and a few other things and marketing, that it just, or it was either that or Iron Man. One of the two of them got delayed crazy, and was the time scale of like Iron Man came out, and then I think it was Iron Man came out, and then 2 years later Jurassic World came out, and then like you didn't see Ty Simpkins for a couple years, and then you saw him in Endgame, and then like he was like crazy aged up to it, like a degree, yeah, that didn't make sense.
Yeah.
So like I'll obviously get better specifics for it once, but like there's that age gap from when you saw him last to when you next see him, the math doesn't check out. And like and then all of a sudden he's like a grown actor playing these like hardcore roles, like in The Whale in Insidious Red Door, where he's like a full grown adult. It's like just a couple years ago he was in that. Like, wait, what? He was like a small child. What happened?
Oh God.
So like I've just found that whole thing very interesting. Not to go on a whole full blown tangent, but it's fascinating, because I've watched people like really lose their minds over that.
The internet. Yes. Talk about astral, yes, projection, but yes.
Exactly. And getting into some of the actors, you know, we mentioned Rose Byrne and Patrick, mm-hmm, Wilson, who does a, yeah, great job as Josh Lambert. He actually came back for The Red Door just this last year, not only to star in, but also to direct. He did a great job with it, in my opinion.
I actually saw Patrick Wilson once when I was in New York. He was on,
no way,
Broadway. He was doing Barefoot in the Park.
That's cool.
And he was really good. Like his range, like he's a really good theater actor. I love, he's a really good film actor. I believe he can sing, at least I'm going off of when he was in Phantom of the Opera all those years ago.
That's right. He had that Rossum, long flowing mane.
Yeah. I'm assuming that's his singing voice that they are pumping in, but
I'm pretty sure that, what's her name, who played Christine, did Emmy Rossum.
Emmy Rossum. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
So I would imagine that was him singing, but yes, just a nod to his range as an yeah, actor.
Not to mention Watchmen.
Oh yeah, of course, yes.
Yeah, so yeah, and then you have Lin Shaye, who kind of carries the franchise in several installments going forward. She's fantastic. Specs, played by Lee Whannell, who is co-writer. Angus Sampson, who was in the Mad Max Fury Road and Furiosa. And then I find super interesting that the lipstick-faced demon was played by Joseph Bishara, who did the score not only for all Insidious movies, but all Conjuring movies.
All right.
The dude is kind of like the king of creepy vibes.
How? That is, we talk about the lipstick-faced demon. How much time and makeup do you think that would take?
Oh, years.
They're still doing it right now.
They're still doing it right now. They're in prep for next year's Insidious. Yes. That's coming out over the summer. They're he's in the chair right now for that movie. But yeah, I do think he did a fantastic job across the entirety of the franchise. I mean, I've mentioned certain scoring artists in the past for horror, but I mean, he is in his own world in the best way possible. Like he clearly has like a workshop of chaos of stuff that he just makes all kind of creepy vibes. Like I like love just playlists of his stuff around this time of year because it's just reliably spooky.
Yeah. Oh no, definitely. There's a lot of, and I know we haven't gotten touched on like the score yet, but like the opening, The Conjuring has it too, but Insidious, that plucking of like the violin string or something, that weird, you know, like when it's off key,
yeah,
when the Insidious graphic title card comes up and it's just like,
I think they call it the Insidious plane.
Yeah,
that track? Yeah, it's yes. Wild. It's like so outrageously absurd, but like not with a negative connotation. Like, hey, just absurd in a good way.
Yeah, hey, do me a favor. Cut that part out of me giving my interpretation of the noise.
Do I have to? Because it's really good. I'll tell you what. I'll send it to you. And see
you can keep it. I'm just kidding. But
no, I love it. That's why that was my hesitation. I was like, oh, do I have to? Because it was really good.
But it does. It is that hellish sort of sounding. Like it hurts the ears a little bit. But
it does. Like I think it's kind of designed. I think a lot of his stuff is kind of designed to be a little bit physically painful.
Yeah, I would say so. Yes.
Yeah, it's just it has that element to it, and he tailors it so perfectly to each of these characters too. Like it's, but still fitting into like an overarching style. Like he just does a great job. Like we haven't mentioned the Bride in Black, who's also kind of like a core character.
Yeah,
especially for these more, first two installments.
Yeah, but it becomes a bigger one role in the second part.
Yes, very fascinating character. It's kind of like the long-standing tormentor of Josh Lambert.
Mm-hmm.
And again, to get into spoilers, fairly warned, she eventually, the final moment is that she ends up actually possessing Josh. Josh is successful in saving his son by bringing him back, but at a cost to his own, I don't even want to call it sanity, his own well-being. He's completely taken over by the Bride in Black, and she ends up killing Elise in this penultimate moment. We get the great Scooby-Doo moment with Renai running around the house looking for Josh, and then she can't find him and is just shocked and bewildered by Elise's dead body inexplicably there. Yeah. And then Josh just appears behind her very creepily immediately after she realizes she sees the photo, which they do kind of take liberty with in adjusting for the sequel.
Yes. I was going to say, yeah, because I originally, for some weird reason, I never saw the first one. I originally only saw the second one first because I was working at the movie theater and we played it a lot. So I would periodically come in and out. And I was like, oh, okay, what's going on? And then when I would watch then I went back to watch the first one.
I was like, wait a minute, this don't add up.
yeah, wait, what's going on here? I had to, but yes. That happens a lot, you notice, like sometimes when you get a movie, but that it's understandable. Excuse me.
Ooh, I think when things aren't written as like a trilogy or as a sequel, like, you know, going
like,
out.
Because never know, like no one, you always have the intention or the hope that, oh, we can make a couple of these or make this bigger.
Yeah.
But you never really want to go in with the expectation of that because you never know what's most likely it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So that's why some things, like I'm a stickler for continuity and I'm like, oh damn, why is that off a little bit? But it's understandable though.
Yeah. And I do love throughout the course of the film, as Dalton is unconscious, we do learn later on that he is becoming a conduit for, and all these different non-malevolent souls are just drawn to him like a beacon. Mm-hmm. Of light. Like they just crave life, so they're like kind of like moths surrounding a light bulb. They're just kind of,
they crave what they no longer have. I'm thinking of the Poltergeist when she comes. I can't do her voice, but
this house is clear.
When she comes in and says they want her life force, you know, and
my impersonation of her is really an impersonation of Jim Carrey impersonating her. But yeah, very, very interesting. We talked Joseph Bishara, but the entire post-production process for this was very interesting. They used a lot of very creative, like we were talking color a few weeks back with Lauren, you know, a lot of great uses of color, like especially for the introductory sequence and blending it in. Like those were cutting edge effects.
They do. I will say this is they do a good job of the use of color in at least in the first two. And that's something that I think it can get overlooked, especially in a horror. You tend to like think like, oh, okay, just make it dark and scary and creepy.
And it's easy to note that in something like The Ring that like really pioneered a lot of techniques and patterns in an analog format, you know, like obviously that like goes with a certain amount of gumption, but you know, it's easy to glass over something in a digital process that, you know, was dealing with things kind of before their time. Yeah, the, you know, like we said, this only had a budget of, looking at the actual numbers now, of $1.5 million grossed over 100.
Wow, so, only 100, $1.5 million? That was the, that's including the actor?
I believe so. Let me double check.
Holy. Because I'm not saying like, I mean, those are some, I mean, Patrick Wilson and Rose Byrne are like, even at the time when this came out, they weren't like no names. At least
especially for, you know, the Wan team after they've, you know, had a few years on Saw. They've like built out the entire franchise of Saw at this point. They've proven they know what they can do. They could have gotten a crazy budget for this if they'd held out, but I think they just wanted to make it fast, and they proved they can do it on a skim budget, which is you know, this kind of has more power than having more money in a lot of ways.
I'm shocked that it was such a low price in the world of filmmaking,
honestly. For 2010, even, like, that's nothing.
That's like nothing for even like 1999.
Yeah, well, it's like we've mentioned too, people always say, oh, well, $1 million isn't a lot of money, or $1 million is a lot of money. Yeah, it is, but it's in terms of like showing how, like, when you have things going out to post-production, out to locations, out to camera gear, out to a crew, you got to pay all these people something, you know, like you look at the whole craft services. Every day you're on set, that money is just flying. It doesn't go very far. I've watched it firsthand go wrong because people think like $20,000 is a lot of money. It's not in terms of this stuff. It's
in
nothing.
That'll
be gone in like a day.
Kudos to them then. That makes this even more of an impressive feat to.
Exactly. It's like there's a lot to this one that, you know, it seems quite simple. You know, there's a lot of things that, you know, don't seem super, super impressive. But when you consider the whole scope of it and all that was achieved on next to nothing, it is very impressive.
No, I mean, to pull off, like I said, there's that. Obviously you have good actors in it, but just to give it that normalcy of when you see, like, when you watch a film in a movie theater, for me, I can't describe it. It's very indescribable, but there's that veneer to it that I'm like, okay, this is a well-crafted, made piece of art here. Whether or not you like it, there's still some aspects, like the sound is crisp, the lighting works, all that. And then what you see up there, when you try to go and make your own, you're like, damn, this is nothing compared to what I see in the theater, you know, just like the style, the way, you know, the lighting, all of that.
It's easy to throw like insults and stuff and say, oh, I could do better. It's like, yeah, you can, but you didn't.
You did. Yeah.
So that's where I come at a lot of this. It's like you gotta look at it like you're being taken to school. It's not and it's not gospel. It's like, this is one way to do it. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to kind of follow that thread. And that's the whole concept of going to the movies for me. It's like, this could have been done a million different ways, but this is the way it was done. And how well does this avenue work?
Yeah.
You know, so it is interesting. And especially, like, you know, like we said, it's next to nothing. It's like I respect like that level of discipline on something. You know, maybe it's especially like, you don't know that it's going to work all the time.
No, you don't. And one thing I do like about the Insidious films, at least the ones I've seen, I have not seen all of them. You have seen all of them, I believe.
Yes, and I do like them. I mean, not getting into like a whole thing, but like I there's a gap in the prequels where things get a little odd. I don't hate the middle ground prequels of 3 and 4, but there is a deviation there where it's like, you can see how people would get deterred or walk off from it.
Gotcha. That tends to happen. Yeah. I was just going to say, I like that the atmosphere that they build, that seems to be what they rely more on.
Yeah.
In this movie, rather than shock value or like gore or violence too much, it reminds me a lot, like when we were in film school learning about the German expressionism movies, the old silent films, you know, like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, you know, the how that lighting and stuff like that worked. This, I think, definitely reminds me, draws from that aspect of filmmaking.
Yeah. Like, you know, we've mentioned before, it builds a tone. It builds a whole world. It does so effectively. And it does so by duplicating locations, too. Like, the fact that the Lambert house, the multiple Lambert houses, obviously through Josh's childhood home, their initial house, the house they moved to, they managed to duplicate those locations within the further and make them, you know, act as duplicates. And, you know, anytime you can do that effectively and have it from a production standpoint, you know, you're that's where you're getting the value of that $1.5 million. It's like, yeah, you only have to acquire so many locations and then you can make their value increased by shooting at them multiple times and making them different places within the further. It's like anytime you can double something over, it's a production win.
No, absolutely.
And, you know, it can work for the story, too, because then it deepens the impact of what the further is. And another thing that I wanted to mention, too, I've found this very interesting because I've been doing a lot of Masterclass lately, watching a lot of it. And I've been catching up with the Duffer Brothers and their whole process of writing Stranger Things. And I thought it was very interesting how much they've drawn inspiration from the entire Insidious franchise. And once you start looking at, like, what Stranger Things has done through that lens, it makes a lot of sense where they drew inspiration from. Obvious visual parallels with the further and the upside down. Like I think, you know, when you take something and spin it like that, it's real fascinating.
No, yeah. And I said it, I always say it. I said it again here. I'll say it again more probably 10 million or other times. Very hard to make something original.
Yeah.
It's how do you take the inspiration that it gives you and put your twist and make something that is familiar and give it that fresh take.
Yeah, it is tricky. And Insidious does exactly that quite well. I mean, it's not drawing from any kind of previous lore. I mean, obviously beyond the obvious, it crafts a world very well and does so fairly originally. You know, obviously not perfectly originally, but I would say it's one of the more original horror films in recent history that I can think of.
Yeah, well, I know we had mentioned that popcorn horror or popcorn type entertainment. It's definitely a stylized look at horror.
Absolutely.
I would say the production design, like a lot of times, I think, at least in more modern horror, when I can think of, like, you know, if like you go through like the 80s and 90s, you have like the slasher films or like Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, which are some of those are have some good entries in them. But
they're all gold.
you tend to, I feel like a novice or someone who is not experienced like myself in filmmaking would.
You always with the
modesty. I'm not good. Anyway.
I cite your Resident Evil.
I can pinpoint when something didn't work out. It's like I'm like George. I can always tell when someone's uncomfortable at a party. But that's it. That's about all I can do. But you tend to like think, you tend to, well, I appreciate that. You tend to think that, like, oh, okay, the horror story, it's like, all right, we just got to think about the scares and maybe the costumes and then we'll rely on the gore or whatever.
Yeah.
We'll let the moments do the heavy lifting for us. If we can just get them to those scare moments, we'll do the heavy lifting for us. You forget about like the sense of discovery that happens in horrors, you know, the mysteries behind what's haunting them, what's the history behind that, you know,
which
you look at,
like we were talking about the lore of all these spirit characters, like this handles that backstory of all these characters so well.
Yeah.
I would say even more so in The Conjuring. Like, this team knows what they're doing with that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, to derail you.
No. I was just going to say, and that's something that I think the Insidious series does well, at least the ones that I have seen, is not forgetting the other pieces to the puzzle that you can tend to overlook sometimes, especially in horror. That's when you see like those, you know, dollar, you know, Walmart dollar bin, whatever. Do they still have those in Walmart? I haven't actually looked at back when DVDs were a thing and VHS and all that stuff.
They kind of don't anymore.
You know what I'm talking about? Those like really like oh, the, five movies in one. Here you go.
Yep. It's kind of voodoo, even though it's Fandango at Home now, which is the stupidest name ever.
Fandango.
which means
which in German means But yeah.
No, like my point being that Fandango does kind of do that with those $5 deals. That's what I dabble in. But
yes.
And the bundle deals, which are cool.
This is one, like, if let's rewind the clock back to when this movie came out, 2010, 11, because I think those bargain bins were still around then that I can recall.
Definitely.
If I were going and looking through the bargain bin and I saw this, I'd be like, now this is truly a bargain, because what is it doing here?
Yeah,
because all the other ones you're like, oh yeah, it's a bargain. It's like, yeah, but it's not a bargain, because it's not worth what you're even charging me. But this one, definitely.
Yeah. And you know what? They've stood the test of time. They're still around. They're still making them. Obviously, there's something to them, because if they were crap, you know, studios wouldn't bother. Well, I guess they would. They would bother. You know? But yeah, like I even up to Red Door. I did like the most recent Red Door quite a bit. I know a lot of people hated it, but I enjoyed it.
What did you take? Because I have not seen Red Door. So what did people seem to hate, and what did?
Without getting too, like, it didn't, a lot of people said it didn't.
Yeah, you don't have to go
too
in depth, but what, yeah, give me your.
A lot of people said that it didn't explain enough. Like, people were expecting more understanding of, like, the lipstick demon, like, because he just kind of was there again. He didn't explain anything about him. I was okay with that, because it's like that Yoda mystery. I'm like, I'm fine with not knowing, you know? Mm-hmm. What I loved about that movie was, so to get into a little bit of it, Dalton goes off to college, and it deals with kind of like the fractured element of the Lambert family, and there's a very strong element of artistry and expression of inner turmoil through artistry. And I thought that take on things, especially in that, and as a thematic element, was just very, very cool.
Very,
especially
nice.
Like visually and like story wise, I grabbed that one.
Okay.
So I enjoyed it. I know it's not a perfect movie, but in like the framework of this franchise, and especially like the story of the Lambert family, I thought it was a very solid entry.
Okay. And there's another one coming out next summer, you're saying?
Yeah. And there's not a lot of details known about it yet. There doesn't have a title yet. You know, there's currently they're planning on releasing one, and I believe August is the current plan. So
okay,
it'll be interesting to see. I'm down to see where they take it.
All right.
I believe that it's planned to still be focusing on the Lambert family, but that may be subject to change. I don't know.
Well, the third one doesn't really focus on
the third one.
It?
Is a deviation. It does not cover the Lambert family at all. It kind of follows another case study in Elise's.
Yeah,
repertoire.
Elise's character. Yeah, yeah.
And it's a prequel to the other two, as is the fourth one. But I believe the fourth one is better. Not that the third one is bad, but it's kind of like that Spectre and Casino, or Spectre and Skyfall syndrome. It's like the one before it was a lot better. It's like the inverse of that. It's like the one after that was really freaking good. So it kind of like overshadows it to a large degree. But that being said, I do really like three. I thought it was fun. It just notably lower on the totem pole to the rest. But that being said, it was good. It's a good franchise. I can understand why people don't like those middle two that deviate from the Lambert family, but you know, I still like them.
I think sometimes people just it can be a weird compliment to what you did, in the sense of, you know, people have grown to, you know, love the characters that you have created, and they want to see more. They want to know what happened or what's going on, you know, all the time that they've invested. It's just like the stock market. I want to know that my investment is going to pay off.
Exactly. Yeah. No, makes sense. But I, you know, it's an interesting franchise. I'm down to see where they take it going forward. It's definitely still got life. Red Door was very profitable last year. Did well, even though, you know, it didn't have like resounding critical success. But honestly, none of the movies in this franchise have had resounding critical success. So
yeah, but no, that's fine. They are also. I hate to say, like, I do it with a book when I say, like, it's an easy read. That's not, I mean, that it's an easy watch. It's a good horror watch. Like,
it has incredible rewatch value.
Yeah.
They still don't get old with me.
I don't mean that as a, you know, to bring it down in any way.
No, no. I get what you mean, if nobody else does.
Well, thank you. But no, it's just, it's one of those movies that, like, yeah, like especially coming into the, you know, the Halloween season here, I think it's one that you can throw on, watch. It doesn't, you don't have to require a full commitment now, you know, it's like, you know, the joy well, like sometimes
to,
I get.
Back to the AMC Horror Fest stuff, like the yeah. old, the ancient horror movies that I enjoyed growing up. It's like those were literally a dime a dozen. Like, you know, this kind of has an element of that, not to like a creatively negative element to say that, but this yeah. like this feels like great popcorn horror that I love.
No, yes, I do agree. And I think it's just that you don't, I still love the fact that there are some things like, you know, you get a lot today where you want to see things as like a series or
yeah.
15 seasons later. I still enjoy a movie and a movie that's, you know, done within, you know, nine, like a 90 minute or maybe like an hour and 40 minute movie.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that. And that's what I mean by saying that these are easy to follow, watch experiences.
Yeah, and I'm on the train for the entire Juan horrorverse.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed Malignant. I thought that movie was wild. I hope they'd actually go through with making a sequel. I would love it. That movie was just crazy in the best way. And you know, I'll take endless amounts of Saw movies because they're kind of like Final Destination for me at this
point. You
haven't
had enough of those yet?
No. I'm in for like the back and forth wrestling of like taking it somewhere new and
yeah.
going back to its roots. Like it keeps going back and forth on that. I'm like, I'm in for it. Like, let's have internal competition within this franchise.
Okay.
For
all right.
Story supremacy. I'm in for it.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I think that team is really cool. They do some interesting stuff, and I'm always down to see what they're up to.
And it's just like,
like, hey, dude, just absurd in a good way.
Yeah. Hey, do me a favor. Cut that part out of me giving my interpretation of the noise.
Do I have to? Because it's really good.